Good morning. Let me go ahead and call the study session for Thursday, August 16th, 2007 to order. The first will be to hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction on the volunteer code enforcement program as recommended by the Community and Neighborhood Service Committee.
Good morning, Mayor and City Council. We're here this morning to do a presentation regarding our volunteer code compliance program that was actually developed by members of our neighborhoods. As you mentioned before, we went before the Community and Neighborhood Services Committee back on June 25th, and they voted to support the program and requested that we bring the full presentation here to council. So that's what we're doing this morning. I have with me Mike Renshaw, who's the acting code compliance director, and he will be doing the presentation.
Thanks, Ray. Good morning. Staff is very excited about this program. Before I start with the presentation, I wanted to acknowledge the hard work, months and months of hard work from a group of very dedicated neighborhood leaders representing four of our registered neighborhoods, many of whom are in the audience this morning. Wanted to start by briefly discussing some of the program benefits that staff sees. It's a long list. We've decided to highlight a few of those program benefits. The first being neighborhood residents would become further educated concerning common code violations in their neighborhoods. Also, an additional resource would be provided that would allow staff, code compliance officers, to focus on those violations that are more difficult to resolve, those cases that are more difficult to resolve. The neighborhood volunteer code team would provide a resource that would focus primarily on the 90% of violations on properties of which are voluntarily abated, voluntarily removed. Wanted to provide a brief background concerning how the code team was formed. As I mentioned, many months of work, hard work by the neighborhood leaders. Registered neighborhood leaders had met throughout 2006 to discuss ways to enhance the effectiveness of code enforcement in the city. The four registered neighborhoods that participated beginning in 2006 were Marlboro Mesa, Mesa Grande Community Alliance, the CARE Partnership, and the Golden Hills Homeowners Association. At the end of the discussions, the meetings, over that course of about 12 months, the team finally recommended using neighborhood volunteers to assist in identifying and correcting some of the more common and minor code violations that we see in our neighborhoods. And I wanted to note also that this model is based on the popular Fort Worth, Texas Code Ranger program, which has been in existence for about 14 years, and very successfully, I might add. Talk briefly about how staff sees this program being rolled out and implemented. Staff is recommending introducing the program as a one-year pilot in those four neighborhoods that I had mentioned. A program evaluation based on some comments that staff received from the June 25th presentation to the Community and Neighborhood Services Committee. Staff decided that it would be appropriate and important to provide a six-month update as far as the progress of the code teams in the neighborhoods. The code teams would address, as I said earlier, the minor, more common nuisance violations. And examples of these nuisance violations are inoperable vehicles, improper outside storage, excessive outside storage, and parking on unimproved surfaces. Those are just examples. Staff would also encourage the team leaders and the code team members to utilize existing resources that the city has in place right now to assist in removing some of these identified violations. Examples of these existing programs are the tool lending program, the code repair program, and the paint reuse program. With regards to the structure of the Mesa Volunteer Code Teams, each neighborhood would have a team leader that would be assigned, one or two depending on the size of the neighborhood, and that team leader would be responsible for coordinating the activities with the Code Compliance Division. Team leaders would also be responsible for registering their neighborhood if they're not already properly registered with the Neighborhood Outreach Office. Team leaders would be responsible for obtaining and distributing volunteer applications and the volunteer agreements for all of the Mesa Code Team members in that neighborhood, as well as distributing a Mesa Code Team brochure that the team has put together. And this brochure would basically explain to the neighborhood group what the purpose of the program was, kind of introduce the parameters of the program to the neighborhood. Team leaders would also be responsible for scheduling through the Code Compliance Division and the Neighborhood Outreach Office all of the required training for their teams. And I'll talk a little bit more about the training in a moment. And also, we would ask the team leaders to meet regularly with their liaisons in the code compliance office to discuss team performance. The team training that's currently being developed, there's a training curriculum that the Code Compliance Office and the Neighborhood Outreach Office volunteer coordinator is actually putting together right now. The training would cover, as I mentioned, the City of Mesa volunteer orientation, including a waiver of liability and the volunteer agreement. It's a standard agreement that volunteers that do work in the city complete. Training would also include how to recognize those more common nuisance violations, the minor nuisance violations in the neighborhoods. Team members would also be trained on how to observe, record, and properly report this information to their team leaders and then ultimately to the Code Compliance Division. And also some information regarding grounds for removal from the program would be presented to the code team members and the team leaders. And I'll, again, address these grounds for removal in a moment. The process itself, the Mesa Code Team process itself, to the credit of the residents who put this thing together, is brilliantly simple. Following a training period, logs of violations and addresses would be kept by each of the team observers and ultimately submitted to the team leader. The violations that are recorded would then be reported to the Code Compliance Division. A Code Team courtesy notice would then be mailed out by the Code Compliance Division itself. And the violator, the property owner who received the courtesy violation notice, would be given 10 days to abate or remove the violation. At the end of that 10 days, the code team, the volunteer code team member, would again revisit that property and do an inspection. And if the violation still exists, then that case would be referred to the Code Compliance Division for the standard enforcement through Code Compliance. It's important to note, I wanted to mention also, that these two processes are completely separate. The volunteer code team process and that 10-day courtesy violation notice is separate from the official, the more formal code compliance process. And the next slide is just kind of a visual depiction of how that process will work. Some additional responsibilities, primarily for the team members themselves, the volunteer team members. We would ask the team members to further educate their neighbors on common code violations. We would also ask them to assist in the recruitment and training of additional volunteers in order to sustain the program and keep it growing in the neighborhood and other neighborhoods, hopefully. We would also ask them to observe and record all violations in the neighborhood, again, the minor code violations, and to communicate consistently with the Code Compliance Division. And again, we thought it was important to kind of lay out some ground rules, grounds for removal from the program, based, and again, a lot of these are based on some benchmark and best practice studies that the volunteers have done over the course of the past 12 months, primarily with the Dallas, the Fort Worth, Texas example. The list is long. This is not all-inclusive. There's probably going to be some additional parameters and guidelines that we build in, but basically one of the grounds for removal will be distribution of non-approved communications, an inability to work cooperatively and effectively with the neighborhood and with their other team members, repeated reporting of non-violations, failure to follow proper reporting procedures, deliberately supplying false information, selective enforcement, and the last two are particularly important, carrying a weapon while observing, even if licensed to do so. And most importantly, trespassing on private property. It's going to be made very clear to the co-team volunteers that they are not to go onto private property. All of the observations and recordings that they make will be from the public right-of-way, from driving by down the street in their vehicles, or perhaps walking by. But there will be no trespassing on private property allowed. And finally, we wanted to discuss some of the broader team goals. We feel that this program, staff feels very strongly that this program will create a greater sense of community by encouraging cooperation and greater neighborhood pride. It's also going to free code officers in participating neighborhoods to work on those more difficult cases to resolve, difficult and time-consuming cases. We see a definite benefit in terms of cost effectiveness. And also, neighbors will become more aware of existing city codes. Education is a big piece of this program. In addition to the cost savings or the cost effectiveness in allowing our code officers currently assigned to investigate those more difficult cases, We see primarily one of the main focuses is neighbors will become more aware of the city codes in their area. And lastly, the code team members will become more familiar with their neighborhood. In working with the city and neighborhood outreach for about 6 years, I've seen a lot of these types of programs, and I'm always encouraged when neighbors come together in the interest of increasing and improving the quality of life in their neighborhood. So staff feels very strongly that this program will provide that type of direction in neighborhoods. That concludes the presentation, and Ray and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. Questions? Councilmember Griswold.
More of a comment than a question. You know, when I first heard this program, I was concerned about the neighborhood Nazi getting control of this, and I think you've built the checks and balances in there. And one of the bigger problems, and I think it is when people aren't educated what is a code violation and not. So I think this will cut down a lot of the calls we get. It is not illegal to build an ugly house. I'm sorry, you know, and those kind of things you get called on. But I think involving good people in their neighborhoods to build a strong neighborhood, I think it's a real positive. So I'll look forward to seeing how this trial works. I think it could really give some good new eyes and some help clean up some of our more troubled neighborhoods. So I'm looking forward to seeing how this works on a trial basis.
Let me ask a couple quick procedural. The neighborhood gets together. Do they vote and elect a team leader? Or does code compliance go out, meet with the neighborhood and appoint or suggest this person be team leader? How does that take place?
Mayor Hawker, the way that the program we see it unveiling right now, the neighborhood basically would appoint or nominate a leader. And I said, depending on the size of the neighborhood itself, could be one or two. You want to kind of limit the number of leaders in each neighborhood just to logistically make it
okay, then somebody that's going out and saying and observes a code violation in their mind and they take it to the team leader. Does the team leader, does that code violation automatically get a 10-day notice from the observer, or does the team leader concur with that observation?
The logbook that each of the team members will be maintaining is given to the team leader for processing. Basically, that team leader will be responsible for kind of going over the way the information that was entered in the log, making sure that the information was correct. There'll be some checking in regards to the property ownership. It's done perhaps by the team leader, but and ultimately that team leader will provide that information to code compliance.
But the team leader is under no obligation whatsoever to go observe the property him or herself to concur before the 10-day notice is sent out.
That's correct. I mean, that's unless
one of the things that we are doing with the program is we are encouraging the team leaders to verify, especially with the beginning of the program, just to make sure that the observer is really noting the actual violation. So we are doing that as an initial step, especially during the pilot, just to make sure that the observers know exactly and to verify. And once they feel comfortable that observer really understands the violations, then there won't be a need to follow up on it. But we do encourage the team leaders to follow up by verifying the violations.
And can a team leader write up and send out his own notice?
Yes.
Who observes the team leader?
We will. We will observe the team leader. But understand that the team leader is the one that more than likely right now in our pilot neighborhoods will be the people that were actually on our committee, and they will be the team leaders. So I think for right now we'll have a good way of monitoring that and be able to verify the work of the team leader, and until we go through the process and maybe even develop even a closer way to do that.
Now, how do you know these people will be your team leaders? Because they haven't even had the meeting yet, have they?
Well, they've been part of developing the program over the last year, and they've decided to go ahead and take the leadership role in each one of their neighborhoods.
So are the neighborhoods already established? Well, who will be the observers and who will be team leaders?
Right now, we already have the team leaders for each one of the pilot areas. The only things that we do not have yet are the observers for each one of the neighborhoods.
Okay. The other one is the concealed carry. How do somebody sign away their right to conceal carry? You said no weapons.
Well, what we decided to do is during our volunteer waiver thing that they have to sign a form, we are asking them, and during the training process, we are asking them not to carry a weapon. Again, there's no way for us to specifically enforce that because we don't know what a person really does or does not do. But what we can do is if they are caught, because during the training process, we're specifically telling them not to carry a weapon, and if they're found to be carrying one, that they will be removed from the program.
Okay. I have a little difficulty with the concealed carry right and wanting to volunteer and not being able to walk down a public right-of-way and maintain that right. I don't know if many people will do it, but I don't know that adds anything to it. Obviously, they're not going to be aggressive because they've already been trained and taken background checks themselves before they were issued that permit. So that one, I'm not sure I'm going to die over that issue, but that's not a good analogy, is it? Going to lose the vote over that one, but I do have a little difficulty with that being added to it. Vice Mayor.
A couple of things. First of all, as I look at your sequence, it looks to me like what the neighbors are doing is they are noticing things so that you can then send the courtesy notification out. The courtesy notification will be sent from your office, not by the team leader. Team leader will send you the addresses, but you will send the courtesy notification.
That's correct.
Before an actual notice of violation, which is the real step that starts taking you through where you get fines, occurs, you have a city employee, a code enforcement officer involved. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I just want to make sure that was really clear, because this is not giving citizens the right to write tickets on their neighbors, which they then have to pay a fine for.
Absolutely not. This is just strictly for an educational purposes. And this deals with the 90% of the people that really take care of their property and do a really good job of doing that. And this is just an educational process. And again, if somebody fails to respond to the notices, then they'll ship them to us and we'll go ahead and start our own enforcement procedures.
So hopefully we can use our code compliance officers then to do the work of the more difficult cases. And I'll tell everybody, I actually got a code compliance violation a few years ago. I had a branch. I know it's shocking. I had a branch on a tree that was sticking out in the right of way, and frankly, you know, first impression when I got it was, I was not happy that I had gotten that. And the second thing that I thought was, gee, I'm glad somebody told me before somebody walked into it and I got sued. So, you know, there's that initial feeling is not a positive feeling when you get a code compliance violation. I don't know too many people who jump up and down and say yippee skippy. On the other hand, there is a really good reason for it. There are a lot of good reasons for it, but from a homeowner standpoint, I was actually grateful for it. Rex said that you can't. How did you phrase it, Rex? That it is not illegal to build an ugly house, and that's one of the things that we struggle with is bad taste versus code violation. There are people who choose to decorate the yards of their homes in very unusual ways that offend their neighbors, but those are not code violations. So that training is going to take place with these folks.
Correct.
The other thing is, as I looked at all of the neighborhoods, they all have, you know, one of these is not like the other, one of these is not the same. Do you know which one it is? It's Mesa Grande Community Alliance. Because the area of the Mesa Grande Community Alliance neighborhood, which is a fabulous organization, I'm not speaking negatively about the organization, but it basically goes from the Tempe border over to Stapley Drive. And it goes south, as far south as Broadway at one location, and it comes up to Main Street at other locations. But that isn't a neighborhood as we typically define it. So are you taking this in you're starting out with a little bit smaller piece of the Mesa Grande area, or what's the plan here? Stephanie's nodding her head back there saying yes. Definitely, she doesn't want to do the whole area.
Mayor Hocker, Vice Mayor Walters, yes, we've had some discussions about that due to the size of Mesa Grande as far as breaking that off into smaller pieces, and we'll leave that up to Stephanie Wright and Tanya and Dave to kind of decide which neighborhoods within the larger Mesa Grande Community Alliance are selected to participate. Well, several smaller registered neighborhoods within the alliance itself.
And given the people you have asked to decide about that, I'm going to guess that the area that's immediately adjacent to Westwood is going to have this voluntary team doing action in there. I think it's actually a good idea. I do have some concerns that you obviously have too because of your ground rules for removal from the program. Sometimes people become overly enthusiastic and it causes problems. So I think that your ground rules are a good idea, and I like the fact that we're doing it as a pilot to see how it goes. So I'm willing to support it on that basis. Thank you.
Tom.
A couple of issues. On the following up on the weapon issue, I mean, if an observer is driving their car to the grocery store and they're carrying their weapon pursuant to their carry concealed permit, and they see a code violation, do they have to ignore it, drive home, put their gun away, get back in their car, drive by the same location, then observe it?
Well,
I mean, to what extent are we going to be really enforcing these rules?
You know, these are intended as guidelines. And again, our biggest concern is basically not to encourage people to carry them just for fear of having to go down the street or for whatever reason. No, we would accept that. We would not, you know, most of the violations that will be reported will probably be reported while somebody's driving by their property versus, you know, walking by and so forth. So, you know, it's nothing that I think we're going to be real strict about. However, it's something that we, you know, highly recommend.
Yeah. Well, there's a part of me that understands that, because there's a piece missing from this grounds for removal, or maybe from the whole program, that really concerns me. And the way I envision a program like this working is that the observer has absolutely no contact, oral, written, or any other, with the owner, the property owner. Because if they do, situations are going to escalate quickly, and if the observer is carrying their gun, then it might escalate even further than we want it. So to me, if you're going to have, I mean, I think it needs to be emphasized in here, and it hasn't been mentioned at all, that the observers are not to make contact with the property owner in any form whatsoever about the violation. Is that what's intended?
Yes, sir. That's exactly what's intended in the program. And again, we will cover that. Again, this is just a synopsis.
Right, I understand.
Of what we're trying to do. And the other things, like we're not encouraging binoculars, for one thing. That's another thing we're not encouraging people to do. And we're definitely not encouraging
printing lift trucks so that they can get higher,
yeah,
and get out over the fences, you know?
You know, cameras, those kind of things. We are telling the volunteers not to do that. Just strictly drive by, denote the address, remember the violation. Once you leave the area, write it down and pass it on.
Or I suspect there are going to be some people who are going to actually assume a weekly walking route.
Right.
And they're going to sort of become, that's going to be part of their weekly or daily routine. People find pleasure where they can, I guess. There is another part of this that bothers me, and you know, Claudia, you remember how you felt when you got that official notice, whether it was mailed to you or whether it was stuck to your door. There is going to be official City of Mesa notices going to our citizens where no city employee has observed the violation. Isn't there? Isn't that the way it works?
Mayor Hawker, Councilmember Rawls. No, actually, and I mentioned the two separate.
The official, whether you call it a courtesy notice or it's the official, I'm only talking about the courtesy notice. Courtesy notice is going to come from the City of Mesa. It's going to be in City of Mesa letterhead and a City of Mesa envelope. It's going to be an official City of Mesa document, whatever you call it.
Actually, the plan right now is, and I just had a discussion with this with code compliance staff, the envelope will not bear any city logo. We'll actually be handling the mailings just for financial reasons. So there won't be any city logo used on it. And the form itself, the courtesy violation notice, the code team courtesy violation notice, is going to be basically a checklist. And it's going to be, again, not a formal official city communication. It's not going to be a city form. It's going to be a form that's developed in consulting with the neighborhood groups. They're going to actually have a hand in creating what this form looks like.
Okay.
But it will not be an official until after that 10-day period.
No,
the violation's still
there. I'm only worried about that first notice.
Right.
So who's that first notice going to come from? Is it just going to show up like a tooth fairy with no indications to where it's from or who it is or anything?
The indications that we're trying to do is specialize each notice to have maybe an emblem of the neighborhood, something to recognize that it's coming from that neighborhood group. And one of the other things that we're encouraging is each neighborhood that's involved in the program, most of them have newsletters and so forth, and to advise them that to put it in their newsletter that they're doing this program within their own neighborhood, so people are aware that notices will be coming out, you know, regarding that. So there's going to be a huge education process, which is a big part of the program. And again, it's that's the whole purpose of the program, is to start educating people and reminding them of the minor violations in their area and people that are cooperating within their neighborhood to do this kind of thing.
I'm very leery. I'll just leave it at that.
The answer then is the original notice from the neighborhood group will have a neighborhood emblem and not a municipal emblem.
Correct.
Is that correct? Right. Vice Mayor.
But let's talk about how we do it right now. If you get a call from a citizen and they say, the guy down the street from me has grass that's 18 feet tall, you don't send a code compliance officer out there. You send a letter today that says, this is a courtesy notice. We have been informed that you have grass that's 18 feet tall. You have 10 days to abate this situation. We'll send a code compliance officer by to check it out or something like that. The person can then call your office and say, hey, that's not me. That's the guy next door. You have the wrong address. But the fact of the matter is that today, notices go out based on citizen complaints without a code compliance officer ever having viewed the property. Isn't that
correct.
True?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah. So this doesn't really, this actually steps back from that a step, because it doesn't say, it isn't going to say City of Mesa across the top of it. There was one other point. I wrote a note to myself and then forgot to say it. And that is that in the process of doing this, I see another benefit to this. As I was reading it last night and mulling it over, I thought, you know, there might be some real benefits here in terms of public safety. You have people who are now having their eyes on the neighborhood, and they aren't seeing a code compliance violation. They're actually seeing something that is illegal going on. So as part of your training, are you going to talk to them also about, you know, if you see something, police non-emergency number, here are the contacts, graffiti, you know, whatever it happens to be. It seems to me that the possibility exists for this also to assist in crime prevention or in solving crimes. Have you talked about that at all?
That, it's a great point, and I don't think it hasn't come up in the discussions, but we certainly can incorporate that in the training to make sure that they're aware of, you know, having, because they are additional eyes in the neighborhood, and that would be a great benefit. So we'll incorporate that into the training.
Councilor Whalen.
You know, the discussion about the carrying the concealed weapon, my opinion is I think it would be better just left alone rather than put it in as a prohibition. If you put it in as a prohibition, and somebody happens to not be carrying because of our rules and they get hurt, we've just created a further problem. I don't think it's going to be an issue. I'd rather not address it than address it. If we address it, then we open Pandora's box. If we don't address it, it's up to the citizen. That would be my opinion.
If the idea of having more eyes on the neighborhood to note code compliance is a good one. We have a city staff, in fact, a couple of them that drive by weekly now. We've got trash pickup, we've got meter readers. Why are we using citizens instead of additional city staff that is already going up and down these right-of-ways and could make the observations on a weekly basis?
Mayor Hucker, again, I think, hopefully this answers the question, involving the neighborhood residents themselves, getting them involved, participating in the process, learning more about the process and becoming better educated about city codes is a big part of this, the educational component. That would certainly be utilizing staff resources, utilities and whatnot that we already have could be an option. We just thought that, again, involving neighborhood residents themselves in the process would be a positive for the neighborhood as a whole.
Additionally, just let me add something that, you know, as much as I think we have great city employees, there is nothing better than people who live in their own neighborhoods to really observe things that are going on in their particular communities and really spending time there. They're the ones who are the real eyes and ears on what's going on, and they're the ones that really care about where they live. And those are the ones that are coming forward and wanting to participate in this kind of program. And we want to encourage that, because as much as we get the city employees to go by from different departments for different things, they've got their own goals that they have to accomplish, things that jobs that they have to do. And it's a much better idea if we get the residents to participate in something like this and make them a part of the solution to trying to really maintain the quality of life in their neighborhoods.
I've always believed in multitasking, so I may have a slightly different opinion on that one. But Scott?
Ray, let me throw a hypothetical. Right now, the way the system stands, listening to Claudia, is that if you get a phone call from a resident saying the grass is too tall, you send out a memo on city letterhead. So with this new system in place in these test areas, if you get a phone call from a resident who's not on the team saying grass is too tall, at that point, are we going to change the policy to then forward that to the team leader and let an observer go determine whether that's a violation rather than having us send out a letter?
No, we will not. We will go ahead and respond to that. Again, we will encourage people to participate with their team leader and the observers, but if somebody calls us on a violation, you know, we'll go ahead and respond to it and deal with it ourselves.
Okay.
Only for us to be consistent with dealing with these issues.
Okay. Well, it seems if we're going to have a set of eyes out there with the observers that are trained in identifying code violations, which are actual code violations and which are bad taste, then it might behoove us to have some kind of policy down the road where we actually funnel these things through the neighborhood as this program expands. On a different, and at least that way we're not sending out letterhead and on something that may not be a code violation. With the issue of the weapon, and I said this off mic, so I'll say it again. I think by talking about it, we've addressed it. So it would probably behoove us to have Debbie's office give us a legal opinion on how this could go bad both ways, and see what you think on that issue. Whether we should just leave that alone, or if this should be something that we consider. But ultimately, from what Tom has said too, is that there should be no contact between the observer and the violator. So if there's no contact between the observer and the violator, as is laid out in these rules, there shouldn't be a problem whether they're carrying or not.
Right.
Mayor, Councilmember Summers, I'm not sure I can give any definitive answers because it will depend on the facts of an individual case as it develops. The standard will be the reasonable man standard. So it will be left to a jury. Was it reasonable for the city, let's say an individual who we have the rule in place and the individual is observing the neighborhood and an incident happens and he claims, had I had my weapon, I could have defended myself and I would not have been injured. It would then be up to the jury to decide, was it reasonable for the city to say you cannot carry a weapon at this time? The opposite case, if the individual is carrying a weapon and an incident happens and the victim is not the person with the weapon, so they sue us saying, hey, you placed this individual on the streets, I was injured because of that, then it becomes, well, was it reasonable for the city of Mesa to establish this volunteer program? That's going to be the issue for the jury and the analysis that's going to have to take place.
Okay, and that's okay. I don't expect getting definitive answers from attorneys, so I was good with that.
Sorry.
Excellent, Tom.
How many code compliance officers do we have right now for a city of about 130 square miles?
Currently, we have 13 full-time staff, and we have a one part-time staff member as well, and then two supervisors and a code compliance coordinator.
So that covers 130 square miles, about 460,000 people, and we cut back your staff a little bit last year. Is that right?
Yes, over the last 3 years. We were up to about 19.
So this allows you to work with the slum landlords, the people that really need to have some work done on them, and that lets the common person who has the tree growing over the stop sign or whatever it is just say, hey, you know, this could be a little dangerous to the kids in your neighborhood. So that's basically what we're doing. We're getting the 90% off of you, and you get to work with the real serious ones that I'm dealing with piles of garbage in the front yards and five cars jacked up and those kind of things that could be drop houses at the same time. So get rid of those. Good. I'd like to see this trial program. If we could in 6 months, I would like some kind of report back to us and say, how's it going? What's the problems? What's the good things going on? And see if we need any mid-course direction. But I'm willing to go forward with it.
Councilmember Reynolds.
I think part of the training needs to include some kind of don't be obvious training. I mean, as if somebody is walking along in front of my house with a notepad and walks by, I'm not going to do anything. Somebody walks by, stops, turns, faces my house, starts writing in his notepad, looks at the address, writes and says, I'm going to be out there. Now, that person, the observer, has been told don't have any contact. So unless he, you know, Monty Pythons and runs away, we're going to have an encounter. All right, we have an encounter, then we have the potential of, well, do they carry, do they not carry? I mean, there's got to be some subtlety in this, built in and trained, and these people have got to go, okay, I'm going to walk down this street, and I'm going to remember, and then I'm going to write things down when I get to the end of the street, whatever. But just, you know, don't be obvious about it, and we're going to have those in kind of encounters that are going to lead to the observer being injured or the property owner being injured. And then I think we're back to where we were with the A-frame signs and, you know, how much liability is this worth? And that's why I'm leery. I mean, I'm concerned about the mindset of the individual who takes their duties too seriously. I'm concerned about the potential for personal retaliation. But I'm also concerned about the inadvertent encounter that creates havoc. I'm not happy about what I learned about the way you send out official notices without ever having observed it either. So, different issue.
Councilman Jones.
I think what we're looking at is we don't want to get in the Barney Fife syndrome, pretty much. You don't want somebody who's out there trying to assert themselves and in your grounds for removal where you talk about the harassment of property owners or selective enforcement, also it's you don't want to have somebody out there who thinks they can intimidate by carrying a gun or making it known, even though it might be concealed, if they make it known, hey, I'm the one who's looking, I'm overseeing this whole place, and that's what we're trying to avoid. It needs to be very discreet of what they're doing, because all it is we want information. Because we do not have enough staff to go out and get that information. And yes, we rely on the trash collectors and such, but they're not going to. Well, if they stopped and wrote everything in my neighborhood, because I'm in an older neighborhood, then they ever get the trash picked up. And the way they've come through recently, and I've complained about when they're picking up and slamming them down so fast before they even get it dumped and they've already dropped it, they're not writing anything down. So. This is important that we get neighborhood involvement, but we need to make sure we have the fine balance of those folks understanding that it needs to be very discreet and it needs to be consistent and it needs to be a real offensive situation and not real nitpicky. So I'm in favor of trying the pilot program, but the training is going to be a very key factor in what we do.
Okay. Somebody want to try a motion on this one? Provide direction. I think we have a 3-0 coming forward for a recommendation, at least to hear by council. I think it's posted for that. Vice Mayor?
I'll make a motion, but I need to understand what you need included in the motion. You have some things here that are certainly not all-inclusive. On the PowerPoint that you did, there were things that you talked about, grounds for removal from the program. There were some that you listed as grounds for removal. I believe one of them was like taking pictures of people's property. That wasn't listed here. I'm assuming you don't want a comprehensive list of what it is we think should be grounds for removal. The motion will be about accepting the program. You will then work with the city attorney's office on these issues to a greater degree, right?
Vice Mayor, we can certainly work with code compliance and give them advice in terms of the details of the program. I think you're correct. What staff is looking for now is general direction that council recommends going forward with the program.
I think some discussion about the liability issues would be a good discussion to have with your office before we formally move forward with this. And if you need that incorporated in the motion, I think just giving direction, and I think everybody, I don't know if I should speak for everybody, but I think you heard a lot of people here expressing that concern.
And Vice Mayor, we will talk to the code compliance, and if they're interested, we'll actually provide some training assistance, risk management type training to the team leaders and some of the volunteers.
Well, I think the council's interested.
Yeah. So a little ahead. I'm sure code compliance is interested.
Yeah. All right. So I will then make a motion that we approve moving forward with this as a pilot to be brought back to the council with a 6-month review on it, and so we get some interim information on it, and I think it's a year's pilot, so at the end of the year, assuming we don't decide to stop it at 6 months because of something we've heard, that at the end of the year it would come back and we would relook at it. The motion is not presumed to include expanding this to the whole city without further council approval.
Okay. Motion and second. Discussion? Tom?
I'd feel more comfortable if I had the policies that are going to accompany this in terms of what is and is not grounds for removal, and actually had a chance to see the training materials that are going to be presented. Now, maybe I thought that's where you were going to go, Claudia, which is that we were going to authorize proceeding, but we're not going to launch until we have this other discussion. The way your motion was written is that we're going to launch now. So I don't know what was intended. I don't think I can support it without, and it's funny, I came here this morning thinking, I read this material and I'm thinking, this is not something that the council ought to spend a lot of its time on. And I'm now 180 degrees to the other side, which thinks I need to really understand what these people are going to be told and how they're going to be trained and what all the rules and regulations are before I feel comfortable going forward. So as the motion is as now, I can't support it, but I could support going forward with another council meeting and discussion before we have the launch. But I don't want to pervert the will of the majority here.
I'm willing to modify my motion to include that if that's an important component. I felt like, for me, giving direction that take place and involving the city attorney's office took care of my concern, because I know how concerned they are about litigation. But I'm willing to modify the motion if that's the will of the council.
Other discussion? Scott?
I'd be okay with allowing the city's attorney's office to take a look at this and the material, and then letting them go forward at least, and then we can review it at 6 months and see what changes need to be made.
Bring it back to council before that happens, or launch
I'm okay with the city's attorney's office going through it.
Right. Kyle?
I let it go through the process of the city attorney's office, but I would like to see at least a draft before it's fully implemented, so that if a flag does come up, we can... I'm not a full study session on it unless there are specific things we want to discuss, but I'd like to see the draft before it really launches.
Seems like we're a little split here on having the city attorney review it, get a little bit more specific on just what the procedure will be and the instructions. So somebody want to try to capture the essence?
You know, I'm willing. What I'd like to do is, and if this meets Tom's need in the sense of what Kyle was talking about, is modify the motion to have it brought back to council members to look at the draft of it, and if we feel the need for an additional meeting, that we can let the mayor know that we want it to go on the agenda
before launch.
Would that take care
if
of it?
If necessary.
Yeah. So we have an additional meeting on it. If necessary, we could just let the mayor know.
It works.
Does I'll that work? Okay. I'll modify the motion so it includes that.
And no. Second.
Okay. Any further discussion then? And all in favor of the modified motion, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hear an update and discuss air quality legislation. If somebody wants to go to Country Club and 7th Street, they are cleaning off a parking lot and blowing it all into the street as we speak. I drove by that this morning, and there's this big black cloud, and I know there's an air quality alert at the same time, and I forgot the darn number to call. So there's a hotline number, which...
It is the last slide on the handouts that I gave you.
Is it? All right. I should have looked in my packet. I would have had it. Oh, on the handout. I didn't have that with me. All right. I will put that on my visor.
We'll call him right now.
Okay.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. I'm Scott Boucher, the Environmental Programs Administrator, and I'm here today to give you a air quality update on PM10 and ozone, and specifically discuss an air quality bill that passed in the 2007 legislative session. First, just to summarize the commitments that we've made as far back as 1997, the City of Mesa has made PM10 commitments. You may recall I was here in July of this year, and the Council adopted 9 additional measures. These measures are designed to further reduce PM10 emissions. They've been submitted to MAG, and MAG is currently using them for air quality monitoring or modeling, excuse me. They're using not only the measures that the City of Mesa adopted, also the measures that other municipalities, the county and state, have committed to. That modeling is scheduled to be completed sometime in September of this year. The specific bill I'll be discussing today is Senate Bill 1552. It was an air quality bill. Many of the requirements, I'll let you know, that are in Senate Bill 1552, the City of Mesa has addressed either with the 9 commitments that we made this year or previous commitments that we've made back to 1997. There are some minor changes, mostly ordinance changes, that will need to be made, and Environmental Programs is going to be working with the City Attorney's Office on making those changes, and we'll be coming back probably sometime the end of the year, the beginning of the year, to bring those ordinance changes forward to you. Just briefly, I'd like to discuss ozone. We are still in non-attainment for ozone in the Maricopa County region. Attainment is required by 2009. They will use data from 2006 through 2008. We have not had any violations of the 8-hour ozone standard for 2005, 6, or 7, but we're not quite through the ozone season this year. The high pollution advisory you were mentioning, Mayor, was for ozone yesterday. Ozone's a summertime pollutant, so once we get through the summertime, late August, September, the ozone season kind of ends, and then the PM10 season seems to begin in the wintertime. So once we get through, if we have the clean data, the MAG will be submitting to be redesignated as attainment for the ozone standard. One of the things created with Senate Bill 1552 was what's called Area C. If you look at the map, it's the blue portion on your map there. Includes a lot of Pinal County, excluding the Gila River Indian community. And the requirement with Area C is that they have the summertime gasoline, the oxygenated gasoline. That's a major requirement that comes out of that with ozone. The big problem that we have is with PM10 right now. Just to give you a regulatory summary, it's a national standard, air quality standard. It's a health-based standard that was passed with the Clean Air Act, so everybody must nationally must comply with this standard. If you look at the map here, the blue area is basically the urbanized valley area. That's our PM10 non-attainment area. And just to give you a brief summary again, 1996, we were designated as serious non-attainment for PM10. We've submitted state implementation plans to try and get into compliance with this standard. We were required to obtain attainment by 2006, but we had continued violations, numerous violations in 2005 and 2006. In 2007, there have been 5 exceedances of the standard at numerous monitoring locations, but these have been flagged as high wind events. There is an ability to flag them as natural events due to high wind, and the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality is responsible for doing this, and they are confident that EPA will accept that these were natural events due to high winds. You may recall there was a large dust storm, I believe it was July 19th, when a huge wall of dust came into the valley. There were 6 monitors, I believe, that violated that day, but we can show that that was a high wind event, that it was a natural occurrence, and that gets flagged, and it does not count as a violation. The adverse consequences, we are required to submit a 5% plan. That was what I came and discussed in July of this year. We have to show 5% reductions. That's what MAG is doing with the modeling that they're doing, and we also must show attainment at the monitors. The adverse consequences are there's possibility for tighter controls on industry in the valley, and also the loss of federal transportation funding, which MAG estimates are around $1.1 billion over a five-year period. I will get into now the specific requirements of Senate Bill 1552, and then also the following slides would be the city status, where we stand as far as ordinances and city operations. The first one is we must develop a plan for stabilization of unpaved roads, alleys, and shoulders, focusing on unpaved roads with greater than 100 average daily trips, and focusing also on arterial shoulders. The plan must be complete by January of 2008. It must include performance goals, schedule for implementation, and also the funding options. Now, all of this data the City of Mesa does currently collect. We are working right now with the transportation folks on putting it into a plan format so that we would be able to provide this to anybody who may ask for this plan. Currently, the City of Mesa does have less than 1 mile of unpaved roads, so the unpaved roads really aren't an issue of city unpaved roads. We do have 84 miles of unpaved alleys, part of the alley abandonment program. We have put that in our commitments that we have the pilot program. We're hoping that that'll help reduce the number of unpaved alleys that we have, and it also reduces the vehicle trips on those alleys when we gate them off. We have 64 miles of unpaved shoulders, and those are stabilized every year using our environmental compliance fee. There's $150,000 set aside from the environmental compliance fee that goes to stabilization efforts every year. Leaf blowers, I know, has been a discussion in the past. By March 31st of 2008, we must prohibit the use of leaf blowers on high pollution advisory days by city contractors and city employees. And we also must pass an ordinance by March 31st that prohibits blowing of landscape debris into public roadways. Currently, the landscape contract that facilities maintenance monitors does prohibit the use of leaf blowers on high pollution advisory days, and our facility maintenance staff works to make sure that they comply with that. And we also have our stormwater ordinance that prohibits the placing pollutants into our streets, which our streets are considered part of our storm drain system. We are examining the possibility of adding this to our particulate pollution ordinance, so it's more clear to our citizens that they cannot blow landscape debris into the street. So we're looking at possibly adding that to our particulate pollution ordinance. We also must have an ordinance that requires by March 31st and enforced by October 1st of 2008 the stabilization of parking lots. There is a residential exemption for parking lots less than 3,000 square feet. Currently, and we also must specify the stabilization method that they're going to use. Currently, with our particulate pollution ordinance, we have parking lots greater than 5,000 square feet must be stabilized. We got this 5,000 square foot number from the county rules. That's currently what the county has, a limit of 5,000 square feet before the parking lot must be stabilized. We will need to remove that square footage requirement, and we'll also have to add a specific methods in which they will stabilize those parking lots, whether that's asphalt or concrete. Also, we need to have an ordinance that restricts vehicle use on unpaved vacant lands. We do currently have our particulate pollution ordinance requires that they be stabilized. And we also have our code compliance folks. It was one of the things that they were discussing with residential areas on unpaved or unimproved surfaces. They cannot park. In fiscal year 0506, they issued approximately 2,500 violations for that. We also, the environmental program staff, inspect city properties on a monthly basis, city vacant lands, to ensure that they vehicles are not driving over those properties. And if, in fact, we do find that there is vehicle use on our vacant lands, we're installing other control methods. Sometimes it's fencing or bollards on those lots to prevent vehicles from using those lots. Street sweepers, by March 31st, we're also required that all new or renewed contracts require the use of PM10 efficient street sweepers. Currently, the street sweeping is done, it's contracted out for arterial roads, and for residential and collector streets, it's done by city staff. Our current contract requires that they have PM10 efficient street sweepers. That contract's going out for renewal, and we have left that requirement in there. And currently, the City of Mesa has 7 street sweepers, and all of these sweepers are PM10 compliance sweepers. Off-road vehicle use, we must have an ordinance that prohibits the use if the area has been closed by the landowner. Now, this does not apply to unpaved roads. One of the parts that comes into play with an ordinance change is they are requiring this be a Class 3 misdemeanor if somebody is, in fact, found guilty of using an off-road vehicle on an area that has been closed. And there's also a possibility that the judge may require community service for anybody who is found doing this. Our current ordinance does prohibit the use if it has not been stabilized to reduce or prevent fugitive dust. We do not have the requirement that it be a misdemeanor, so we will be working with the city attorney's office to try and address that issue. Also, our city properties are inspected on a monthly basis, as I mentioned, and our police department has a trespass program that if you sign your property and you submit a letter to them letting them know that they can enforce without contacting the property owner, the police department can then enforce the no trespassing without having to track down the property owner before issuing citation. There are reporting requirements associated with this. The city will have to report twice a year the number of NOVs and fines that we have issued. We also have to report the number of enforcement personnel that we have and our stabilization numbers as far as shoulders, alleys, and roads. There are some requirements for the state and county. I would like to note that the county, the measures that I mentioned previously that the city has to comply with, those same requirements do apply to the county, but there are some that apply solely to the county. Most of those fall into the public education side with off-road vehicles. One of the ones that's a state requirement is you cannot operate an off-road vehicle on a high pollution advisory day unless it's in an area that's designated for the use of off-road vehicles, such there's certain tracks in the valley that operate and charge and have dust permits to operate off-road vehicles, and they have control measures to control the dust. But also public education for anybody who rents or sells off-road vehicles, they will have to provide public education on local ordinances and the rules that apply to the use of those off-road vehicles. The same goes for leaf blowers. There's also a training requirement for anybody who is paid to use a leaf blower, so landscapers will have to attend a training once every 3 years, and then anybody who rents or sells leaf blowers will have to provide that public education on local ordinances and rules that apply. One of the requirements that will affect the city is a dust coordinator. There's dust coordinator training that must be done once every 3 years. This will apply to any construction sites greater than 5 acres. And it also applies to, the city has a block permit for routine dust generating operations that are done by our utilities folks, transportation, and parks, such as trenching or maybe some grading that is done. We will have to have somebody who, during those dust generating activities, is trained as a dust coordinator and is certified as a dust coordinator when those activities are going on. We've had the discussions with transportation and utilities, and once that training is made available, they'll designate the people that they want to attend that training. There's also an agricultural general permit for dust generating activities. Presently, they have to have one best management practice in place. They've committed to adding an additional best management practice. It's kind of a checklist that they go through to receive their general permit, and they must do this by December of 2007. Mayor, here's the hotline number for you. It's 644-3599. And I've marked down Country Club and 7th Street, and I'll make sure somebody goes by there today and takes a look at it. So at this time, I'll open it up for any questions you may have.
You talked about improvement once we do alley abandonment. Now, are we changing the surface in there? Are we putting more rock down, doing asphalt? What, or are you just saying because it'll reduce unnecessary trips through those alleyways?
Right. The reduced trips in those alleyways mean that they will stay stabilized longer, and you just won't have the amount of traffic that is then going out onto a paved surface.
Okay. We've already pulled all our refuse trucks out of those alleyways. We still have an issue with the contractors dumping their loads in there.
Right, and that's one of the things that with the alley abandonment can assist, but we did see a large drop-off. We did a lot more stabilization in alleyways when solid waste vehicles were going through them, just because you had those daily trips, and those are large vehicles, so it's difficult to keep them stabilized. But since we have pulled the solid waste vehicles out of the alleyways.
We haven't done stabilization in there.
We have done stabilization.
Where necessary.
What's that?
Where necessary, we've done some stabilization.
That is correct. Yes, our transportation folks take a look at the alleyways and areas that they feel need to be stabilized. We have a contract to do that, and we use the money that we have set aside from our environmental fee.
Other questions? Vice Mayor.
It occurs to me that a lot of people already own leaf blowers, and they routinely blow stuff into the streets. That hasn't been okay ever because of the issue that you talked about with the water quality issue. But I'm wondering what we're doing, and maybe, Merritt, maybe I should be looking at you. What are we doing regionally to do some PSAs, some things on TV, talking to people about you shouldn't be doing this? People move here every day. They bring their leaf blower with them. Even people who have been here a long time don't know that you're not supposed to do this. So what's going on?
I can say that Maricopa County has launched, they just launched in the last couple of months, their Bring Back Blue campaign. And there have been some commercials, PSAs on TV. Their first round focused on off-road vehicle use and also the driving on unpaved shoulders, because that has been a big problem around some of the violating monitors. This is a campaign that will go on for many years. I believe they've set it aside. I forget the amount of money that the county has set aside for this campaign. But I can chat with their folks and see when they're looking at possibly doing. I'm sure that they're going to come out with something on leaf blowers as far as a PSA. And the city of Mesa works with them cooperatively. They had some brochures that they put out with the Bring Back Blue campaign, and we were distributing those at our HHW events previously, just trying to help get the word out.
Well, and that Water Use It Wisely campaign is now out there every place. I mean, but more and more people, it's hard to know how to contact people so that they'll see the information. I almost think you have to get it on TV, because it seems to be the one universal thing that people actually watch TV. There are so many outlets now for news, it's very challenging to know which one to go to. Okay. Thank you very much, Mayor.
A lot of the monitors are located down in the river bottom, lower Buckeye Road, where there's a lot of leftover scrap vehicles that they part out and stuff, and a lot of those lots have not been maintained. So some of the impact has been because the two or three monitors that are always in exceedance are located in those areas. To focus a little bit on what's causing the higher level of PM10 in those particular areas. So some of it's been a concentrated effort to figure out, you know, what's tripping those individual monitors, and the city of Phoenix and the county are trying to cooperatively work together to make sure that the edge of the roads are stabilized, because when the large trucks come by, they turn up that dust along the edge, and then it gets entrained in the road, and then it continues to get airborne throughout the whole day. So I'm used to a circular chart that shows where all of the different airborne PM10 the sources are, and then we try to figure out what's the best impact for the dollars and where's the best educational campaign or where can we spend the money wisely, and go through that effort. There was one that was suggested that the county rejected, and that was no more lot splits unless they also paved. You can't just grade in a lot split. You had to do some type of stabilization on a lot split, and that was rejected. But hopefully that'll come back in a future session, and maybe it'll curtail a couple of issues that we've had in the past with lot splitting. But that's a whole constitutional property rights issue that kind of conflicts with some of what we're trying to do with air quality. But it is the PM10 is a serious one, because as was mentioned, if we don't get into compliance, it can actually stop some of the federal money coming for our highway and street programs. And that has happened in other places, not for PM10, but I think Atlanta or one of the other ones actually had a hold for a number of years, and it stopped their whole construction program until they figured out a way to get into compliance. So we're taking it seriously. The other one was, there was a national standard that went from PM10 to PM2.5, which is more a tailpipe emissions one than it is a airborne dust one. And we're in pretty good shape on that, but we weren't able to switch over completely to 2.5 because we still had this PM10 thing lingering out there that we had to solve. So it gets a little complicated the more you dig into it. But The next presentation, if you'd get that little chart that shows where they're all coming from, I think it explains it fairly well, and then you can see where our enforcement measures are trying to capture those larger pollutants, and they hit them at the source. So, Councilmember Griswold.
Yeah, I'd also like to see where the monitors are, and you know, you've explained to me in the past why the monitors can't be moved. One's in the middle of a field they're plowing and Buckeye, and the other one's down the dry riverbed next to a gravel operation. Those are not good places to take your average reading, in my opinion, and why we can't get those moved where it's the air we're breathing, not next to a gravel pit, I don't understand, or where they're plowing and planting twice a year. Well, what would it take to move those?
There's a lot of monitors. There's like 30 monitors or something like that. This is just the two or three that seems to get the more exceedances.
Right. There are monitors throughout the valley, and some of them are placed. They're placed by EPA, and they look for the worst-case scenarios when they're placing them.
If that's not the one sending us over the trigger, that's fine, but those are the ones constantly triggering us into possibly losing our highway dollars. I would be looking to move those.
Well, they frown on, I don't think you can move them, and they also frown on paving 300 foot in every direction from them too.
Right.
Putting in a sprinkler system next to them, that doesn't work either.
Right.
So they really want the reading that is being created. I think there's also one on Indian School and like Grand Avenue, that intersection for not for PM10 but for ozone, that always seems to get an exceedance too. I mean, it's right, can you trap the air? Is I think there's an overpass or something on Grand, and so, but yeah, we have a couple ozone, of high ones.
The ozone monitors, it tends to be the ones that are then the opposite. The PM10 ones seem to be in the center of town. The ozone ones are on the outer edges of town, because as the tailpipe emissions come from the center in Phoenix and they move out through the valley the way the air moves, and then they interact with the sunlight, you get those high ozone readings in the outskirts. So, and that's why they place those ozone monitors out there, is to look at the worst case scenario.
And you have a westerly wind, so for some reason Apache Junction has exceedances.
Yeah.
You know, because it all moves over there and it reacts. Yeah. Any other questions? I think there was some discussion. There was the MAG managers approved like $6 million for particulate PM10 measures this year in paving streets. And I made a suggestion that we approve $5 million, and Goodyear had $1 million in there that was taken out of the program. I'm not suggesting that we don't put that back in, but we had a formula there that showed the dollars spent to do paving and the tons of reduction in PM10. I just was looking for additional projects to be submitted that may have had a more cost-effective ratio. So that's the whole issue. I think we'll probably reinsert that $1 million, because in EPA, one of our things was $5 million worth of pavement would take place. It was one of our submitted projects, and so we're just slightly under the five. I do want to get that back up, and I don't mind spending the extra million. I just wanted to make sure that the best projects were submitted, and there were some from prior years that weren't resubmitted. Mm-hmm. So if you're on that evaluation team, that's why that one was changed
okay.
at the MAG Regional Council. Councilmember Griswold.
Were any projects from the Mesa area included in that? Because we have large county islands, most of them with dirt roads. I would really enjoy seeing those paved and getting our pollutants down, but the county doesn't seem to be moving in that direction.
We've been working with the county and identifying roads that are in county islands. The problem becomes many of those quote-unquote roads are not in fact roads. They have not been accepted by the county. They are simply ingress and egress agreements between the property owners. So the county won't accept those roads unless they are paved to county standards. And of course the residents don't want to pay the money to have those roads paved. There is a possibility, we are working with the county on some of those roads, possibility with Senate Bill 1552 that some of the requirements that are in there will at least make sure that those roads are stabilized. And there's a possibility that those residents may have to stabilize those roads themselves.
Okay, well, any of this grant money that you're talking about available for that to help residents get these roads paved?
In this case, it would probably have to be a county submittal. I think we've got one more mile left or something.
Yeah, we have less than what we've got, actually 0.73 miles, I believe, and most of those, it's like three different road sections that go to well sites. They're very small portions that there's minimal vehicle traffic on. It's just city vehicles, maybe on a monthly basis, checking on a well site.
Yeah, I asked the same question. If there's anything out there yet to be paved and there's some regional money to do it, let's put it in.
So. All the roads north of McKellops between Power and Usury Pass, all those dirt roads are county, and they send up clouds of dust into our residents' backyards daily. So as soon as those would be done, it would be very, very nice.
Yeah, we have been working with the county, and we have identified that area and have asked to see if there's something that they are willing to do about it.
Okay. Why don't we try a joint submittal? I don't know if you can do that, but put it under Mesa and county because it's in our planning area and see if that gets any other attention the next time.
That would be good.
All right. Anything else on air quality issues? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appointments to boards and committees. I think we have two. Motion and second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Acknowledge receipt of minutes of boards and committees. We have four. Motion and second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Passes. Hear reports on meetings and or conferences attended. Any updates? Scott.
Since returning from China, I've been a little busy and not catching up on sleep, so bear with me. Altier Credit Union on Power and Warner are building a new facility. Mentioned to them it's awfully good time to build with all the development forthcoming. They're looking at delving into the small business loan market, which would be very interesting, coupled with the Polytechnic University, some of the technologies coming out of their small businesses, and the growth we anticipate in the Williams Gateway area. This could be a great market for them. Had the opportunity to individually tour the Mountain Vista Medical Center. Many of you have attended the grand opening. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to do so, so I got the private tour, which is terrific. And I think we're working on that blue sign on the freeway, the hospital sign. Scott, they need a hospital sign. Big ER, no waiting. We want to spread it out. And also was at the Economic Roundtable for the Mesa Proving Grounds, another meeting. I very much encourage your residents of my district to attend these meetings if they can. I live nearby. I was also sent a card with my opinion. So I sent it back saying I give you my opinion every week. But I'll be glad to fill out the cards and send them. But I'll also encourage your residents of my district to send those cards in if they have any ideas about what they like to see developed down there.
All right, I think the majority of the council, hopefully we didn't sit together, so but the presentation at the roundtable was an interesting one, and it just reconfirms, I think, what this council has talked about for years. Let's protect that as a major job center, and I think that DMB is picking up on that same theme, knowing that as Superstition Vistas develops, there'll be a lot of rooftops, and this would be a great spot for an urban core. And I know that the city staff has been challenged to look at it, and new floor area ratio is another type of more, if I want to say modern, but a different way of doing land use planning than we've done in the past. So that'll be a challenge for us to understand it and for the city staff to try to work and make sure that it's a successful project, and I certainly encourage that continuing work. When you hear resort hotels and trying to get a lot of office buildings for the employees here because we're short of offices in the East Valley, these are all things that we've heard about for years, and it's nice to see somebody recognizing it and in trying to incorporate that into their land use plan. So I was very, very encouraged with the roll-up so far. Obviously, we have the hopefully that will not have any conflict with the ability to get traffic in and out of a gateway, because that the synergy has to be maintained, and I think that was also acknowledged that part of what works is the Polytechnic gateway, the freeways, all of the infrastructure that the city has planned. I heard several compliments from the people that were putting it together with the infrastructure, with the CAP water treatment plant out there, with the joint sewage treatment plant, with the power line coming through. All of the infrastructure and is in place or will be in place as this comes online. It'll be a challenge to keep up with it all, with the freeways and such, but this is kind of you know, I think I've described it as the perfect storm for us. All of the parts are blowing in, and it should come up and be really something that we'll be proud of in the future. They also talked about the horizon. Don't expect it overnight. This is a 20 to 30 year build, but let's keep it in this direction and not at this point, hopefully we'll change and cause some hardship for some of those people that are planning on this being a major job center. So it was very encouraging. Councilmember Griswold.
I was at a presentation by M&I Bank, that raised money for a new police dog. I believe they were around $30,000 they raised and for a police dog that was killed in line of duty earlier this year. It's interesting, one of the new aggressive dogs they have is named Kino.
How does he spell it?
Never mind.
It's an honor, Your Honor.
Yeah, it's an honor. Meeting with the Mesa General Hospital last night, board, about preparing their ER room. They're going to be closing the Banner Mesa Hospital on September 18th, I believe. And are they ready to take the influx of emergency patients downtown? It'll be the only downtown hospital left on the west side, on the northwest side. So that'll be a challenge, and hopefully keep our health facilities open in downtown Mesa.
Anyone else? Vice Mayor.
I actually have a question going back to the minutes. Is it acceptable to ask a question about something that's in the minutes when we do the approval of the minutes?
Are you questioning what was actually said, or are you raising an issue in terms of that would lead to a discussion about the issue discussed?
Well, I don't know. It was the minutes on the Museum and Cultural Advisory Board, and there was just a note in there that that there was a challenge that they were having on chargebacks from other departments, and that the Art Center had no control over what was being charged. And because it's a different kind of an operation, I was just going to ask Mr. Brady if they're working on resolving this issue. Am I allowed to ask that question?
We treat everybody the same in the city departments, so we can talk about that offline. But okay. All the departments have the same
unpredictability
formula. It's not, no, it's Mr. Odom can show them how they're charged and how they benefit from their city support services. I mean, it's a full cost accounting is what it is.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Scheduling meetings and general information, Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. We do have a Intergovernmental Affairs Committee meeting following our study session today. And then Thursday, the 23rd, study session will be followed by a Transportation Infrastructure Committee meeting. And then our next council meeting will be Monday, August 27th. Thank you.
Okay, Mike.
Do the league meeting, are we not going to have a study on the 20 or the 30th?
Well, I wanted to kind of pull the council because we have a pretty full, we've tried to put in a lot of stuff between now and the end of the year. But if we start at 7:30, I guess the question I have is I don't know how early some of the sessions start. I know some of you may have some that start at like 9 or 10. But I was thinking if we could do a session, one, just to keep us moving on getting issues out there. Well, let me review the issues with the mayor. But if we could get it done by 8:30, 9 o'clock, would that accomplish? I don't know. I haven't seen the schedule, so I don't know.
My problem is at my own expense, I'm going to have my family staying there, so I'm going to be over there Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday.
Okay, that's... hadn't thought about that.
If we could do one later in the day, if that would work, I don't know.
I didn't bring my calendar of what was on that day schedule.
Or if we wanted to do one Monday, an extended study Monday, we're all available then.
Oh, well, for Tuesday, September 4th? Okay, maybe we'll do that then.
Don't do that, I'm out of town.
There's no meeting on Monday, September 3rd, because of the holiday. So maybe what we would look to do is starting earlier on Tuesday, September 4th. Does that work?
Mayor, I will be out of town at my National League of Cities committee that I'm the vice chair of.
Which, I'm sorry, which
in day? September, for that September one.
It's September 4th?
Uh-huh. So I can call in if I need to, but is there any chance of, if you want to put extra things on, can you put them on the 27th instead?
27th of?
August.
Of August.
In other words, what you were going to put on Thursday,
front load.
Can you move it up to Monday? Can you take a look at that, Chris?
Yeah, we.
I can call in for that council meeting, and I think I send an email to your office and the mayor's office letting you know.
No, that's fine. Well, let me do this. Let me also send out, let's see, what's the date? On the 23rd, one thing I will have in your packet, the items that we've kind of scheduled out for now till, I forget how far we went, Carla. I think we try to go to like November, and you can just see the issues, and that way we can decide which ones we can move back. I mean, we're talking about everything from the planned community districts, the issue that's come up, to talking about the replacement of the ball fields for Riverview Park. Group homes is a discussion that's coming up. So we're doing all kinds of, we have a variety of things. But we'll put the calendar out, then we can maybe have this conversation now on the 23rd. Thank you.
Okay. Huh. Just going on with that more, on my calendar for the league, there is a intensive session on transportation issues at 9:30. So we would, on the 30th. So that would be tough to get to if we had a study session.
And the 101 northbound in the morning.
The 101 northbound, we would have to leave extremely early to make sure we're there by 9:30.
That's why
all the
diligence
work here and not have to travel. We're working. We agree.
Okay, we'll take it. We'll look at that.
Okay, do we have any requests to speak this morning? Okay, then let's go ahead and adjourn the study session.
So moved.
All right. Second to adjourn study session.
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All right, now I need to call a special council meeting to order for the purposes of convening an executive session talk about city clerk. I have a motion and second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, we are in executive session.